country, and I'm going to check with the oscilloscope the time frame for each individual spark based on this article. This article is a perfect study about the spark and spark ups, don't you think?
It sure has a lot of information that I've never seen before, and I've had quite a bit of interest in how air in particular breaks down. And I guess John does also. He and I both own a Wimhurst machine, and we have seen the breakdown of air, and I think we only partially understand why it's always a zigzag.
John?
Yeah, Dick, I'm sure there's a reason for it, whether it's cosmic rays or what, and you'll have it in an S fashion, then it will look like a half a triangle. The waveforms, the arc forms are very different each time. So, and that also is dependent on humidity in the room. That's what I've noticed.
Well, when the room humidity is high, you don't get anywhere near as much high voltage generated out of a Wimhurst machine, and you can't arc a gap anywhere near as far. A dry day allows you to make a really big spark gap. As I said, 3 5/8 inches is my best to date. And there are times when the spark goes so zigzag that it almost looks like it's looping around and making a script E, if you know what I mean. It didn't really. And another problem I've got is the spark gap is so brief. I wish I had a whole lot of high-speed photography to record these. I think if you tried recording them on a video camera, I don't think the frame rate is fast enough to catch the details. I wonder if you've done any photography, John. I haven't yet. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, I have, Dick. I've done it with DIN 27. I just open the shutter all the way, put a lens cap on it, open the shutter, turn on all the lights in the shop, and then take the shutter cover off, crank it up, and I let maybe one spark or two spark goes go by, and it does produce a very nice pattern on it. But the DIN 27 is a very coarse, very fast film, so I haven't tried anything like, say, down to AS8 100, which might give me a better result.
Interesting comment that I would like to make in here. How the plasma originate? Well, the electric field is applied over the gap. At some point in time, a free electron would be created due to cosmic ray, so background radiation. The free electron is accelerated by applied electric field, gains energy, and eventually hits an atom. So the energy of the accelerated electron is high enough, this atom will be ionized and another free electron is created.
And that begins the avalanche approach, the avalanche effect.
Dick, I have some other question for you to see if you would experience this.
Right, let me finish this. So the two electrons will be again accelerated and additional ionization will take place, and this way the electron avalanche is created. So finally, this avalanche is additional process of the streamer formation conducting the channel. But, see, when I talk to you, Dick, and you talk to me, and we at the distance of 3 feet, the energy at a certain point accumulates, which is addition of the energy of mine and addition and energy of yours. Now, here's what is the controversy. If the cosmic ray interacts with an electron, it creates an effect. An effect has to come according to the laws of the of thermodynamics. It is not passive. It is an active interaction. Could that be that enormous power, as we don't know the frequency of the cosmic rays, is simply coming, all this that we're talking about, TK, is coming simply because of a way of finding an interaction or coupling to the cosmic ray and to XGF?
It's my belief that a lightning bolt or a spark gap in many situations is initiated by a cosmic ray. It's my belief. But I'm not actually positive about that. If the electrostatic field in volts per meter is high enough, because the cloud of electrons around a particular atom or molecule are moving around in such an extremely rapid manner, and I'm guessing that in the presence of a strong E field, their orbital parameters get modified because it is a charged particle moving in a electrostatic field. Mm-hmm. If it was a magnetic field, it's being deflected. I still think it's being deflected. I'm not positive that it isn't possible to create an electrostatic, to create an avalanche without a spark gap. The reason I say that is because my belief is I could go down to the deepest mine where very few cosmic rays can get to you. They'd have to penetrate an awful lot of Earth to get there. And if I put a high enough voltage across that spark gap, I know it's going to happen. A spark plug inside of a ordinary combustion engine. A reciprocating internal combustion engine. Let me drop. There are people who have run machinery with an internal combustion engine deep within a mine, and those spark plugs keep right on working. So I'm not convinced that every spark gap, when the voltage is high enough, requires a cosmic ray. I wonder if anyone's got an opinion on that one. K2RIW.
First, the creation of the first three electrons is stochastic, if I say this word properly. And also the electron avalanche formation has stochastic nature, so causing the large short of the, to short time instability, and also limiting the rise time of the switch impulse. So if we're dealing with a cosmic ray that is interacting also deep underground, my question is the cosmic ray, I remember the scientists that were measuring the 100 feet below the ground level, the interaction with the cosmic rays. Question is, how is that process happening before we go to what you said?
I don't think anyone has ever created an environment that is so well shielded from cosmic rays that a spark plug doesn't continue to work. I think if the amount of voltage you're putting across the gap exceeds the dielectric strength of air or whatever the mixture is by a large enough multiplication factor, there's something else that can initiate the event. I think an electron can be freed up from an atom that he is part of if there's a strong enough electrostatic field nearby, and it begins the avalanche process. So if I'm right at the threshold of a breakdown, yes, a cosmic ray can easily trigger it. A laser pulse can trigger it. But if I've exceeded the dielectric strength by 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 times, I don't think I require a cosmic ray anymore.
What about the one factor when the avalanche is created, then the channel is formed and it's spanning a complete gap, but the voltage drops. So what we need is less influence of the cosmic ray in order to sustain the avalanche and to exceed plasma flow.
Now, once I complete the gap with a spark, and I've now established a channel of ionized material, a channel of plasma material. Almost every plasma I've heard about has a negative impedance characteristic. You put more current through it, the resistance drops, the voltage drops. So as you put more and more current across a spark gap, the voltage across the spark gap becomes lower and lower. Because part of what's going on is that I think you're creating a larger number of avalanches per cross section. Exactly why, I'm not quite sure, but that's one possible explanation.
Interject. But again, the question is, what is the energy of cosmic rays per square centimeter?
There is an average. It's probably well documented. I remember seeing a cosmic ray detector at Brookhaven Laboratory 30 years ago during one of their open house presentations. They had a machine which had multiple layers of conducting materials. I don't know if it had air in between or some of the gas in between, with high voltage in between those alternate layers. And you could see the breakdown of sparks that was occurring as the cosmic rays went through. It was kind of a cosmic ray telescope, and it was an exciting thing to watch. The total number of cosmic rays per square centimeter on the center of the on the surface of the Earth, I don't know the number, but I guarantee we can research it, and I'm reasonably sure it's a significant number.
The average human body, I believe I read, takes 200 million hits a day.
Loop circuit that is using the excess of energy to be returned to the source, and that fraction of the energy is...
I heard the 200 million hits per day.
Working device. Would that be possible? If let's say we state for a moment that the TK device works, which I am 100% convinced, but that's me. Would that be that we found a way to actually couple to the cosmic rays energy? And since that energy is simply flowing with the time, another question to you would be, how much of that energy over 1 minute period is passing to 1 square centimeter of the air and to the air?
And John just said that he's read that 200 million cosmic rays strike a human being in one day. Was that the number, John?
Yes, Dick.
Now, a cosmic ray passing through a substance like air, if it doesn't impact an air molecule, there is no energy transfer. Now, a cosmic ray striking a plasma, an arc, is there a higher probability of an impact? Is an interesting question. I'm having trouble believing that even if I had a perfect absorber, I mean, I could make a black body sheet of material, put it in my backyard, let the sun shine on it, and I would confirm that 1,300 watts of solar energy per square meter is taking place. There, those photons are being absorbed. I don't know what substance I could create that will absorb cosmic rays. I think many of the cosmic rays are so energetic that even if they strike one of the atoms of my material, I think they're going to keep right on going through, if you know what I mean. Get deflected a little bit. So my gut feel is that the energy per square centimeter of cosmic rays is small, but even if you knew what it was, absorbing it, I think, is very tough.
So if you take into consideration that when the plasma starts to flow, the current drops, and that means that the amount of energy is additive to the cosmic ray through the conductor, but the power draw from the sources is lesser and to exist.
You said the power drop, and I think you meant the voltage drops.
The power drops and the voltage. Well, no, the voltage drops. The current. Good question. What I think is that we're getting the energy of the cosmic ray that is addition from the other side of the spark gap. So my understanding is that. I mean, it sounds silly, but the more power we have from the other side of the spark than we have before, because the power from the other side of the spark gap is just the power that is addition of the interaction of the cosmic rays. I mean, it sounds unreasonable intuition.
For lots of years, people have been doing arc welding. People have used an arc lamp. When you increase the current through an arc, it becomes brighter. The voltage drop goes lower. It becomes a negative impedance. The excess brightness you get out of an arc when you put more current through it, to my knowledge, has been reasonably well explained. In other words, you know how many volts, you know how many amperes, you know how many watts you're putting into it, and I think there is a reasonably direct proportion of the brilliance of that arc versus the raw DC power you're putting into it. I don't think the extra brightness is being significantly increased by the influence of cosmic rays. I think the real raw power of DC voltage and current you're putting into the arc, to my knowledge, it explains the brilliance of the arc.
So you said that it is possible that cosmic rays may interact with plasma. Now here's the point. The Caduceus coil and the pickup coil, it is at very, very high potential. Let's say 90,000 volts. Now there is ionization everywhere, and it's in one of my videos, I don't know if you've seen, I touched the transformer when I had with my tip of the finger, and there was a blue field of ionized air, looks like a very white spark between my tip of the finger and the secondary of the transformer.
Assuming now that little green transformer was properly insulated, and even if it wasn't, if the frequency is high enough, the skin effect is such that you will not necessarily feel the current. But if the voltage is high enough and you're developing that blue corona glow around something, I think that's a kind of low current breakdown, kind of corona.
It wasn't with the green transformer. That was one of the videos I sent you, the link. Maybe you didn't see that. The last of the series of the videos when I was playing with the flyback driver. Did you see that video?
In other words, the yoke of a television deflection circuit, that's the flyback you're talking about?
Yes, and I showed the schematic of the flyback transformer, and that was the last video. And I was using TIP-142 transistor, NPN transistor for it, and I was playing with it. So I made that video. I sent it during the week, I believe.
I think I did see that one. And I don't remember catching the blue spark, because saying there was a...
At the beginning of that video, I'm touching that flyback transformer with my finger, and then I'm touching the transistor trying to find out if it's hot. It wasn't hot. But my finger, between the finger and the transformer, when I was touching it, there was a very wide blue light, which shows the ionization of the air, and didn't really hurt me.
What was the frequency it was operating at the time?
I was operating about 48 kilohertz.
Which I think is more than high enough to get a lot of skin effect, and as such, that wasn't really penetrating your finger, it was only going across the skin of your finger. I'm guessing that's part of the reason why you didn't feel discomfort, but the voltage was high enough. You were probably operating at, what, 40,000 volts or something like that at that time?
About 25,000.
Yeah, 25,000 at a high enough frequency will make some very nice corona effects. That's what I think you were seeing. I can tell by what you're saying so far tonight that you're hoping that cosmic rays are an explanation for where some excess energy is coming from. There's ways of investigating that, and my gut feel, but I don't know for sure, is that might not be it. Over to you, Wes.
And it's just trying to guess what is going on. Now, the subject number three, just put a quick look. Subject number three, we're not going to fluke isolation amplifier. That is a beautiful article, but let's skip it. Subject number three. Six NOS BOMAC and Sylvania tubes. If you click on subject number three from that email, you're going to see a very strange-looking tubes. I wonder what those tubes are for.
Yeah, when you click on that, you see six of these tubes that look like a syringe side view, but that's not what they are. I don't know what they are.
Yeah, there are two pictures. If you look at the need of the main picture, put your mouse pointer at the second one, and you're going to see if the tube from the side. Unbelievable.
It looks a little bit like the inner construction of a 1B3 high-voltage diode damping tube that was used on television sets in the old days.
I wonder if John has an idea.
Yeah, possibly high-voltage rectifiers. Either that or shunt regulators. They look like they're for high-voltage.
But there's a missing electrode on top. The little tip of the glass has no electrical connection. Strange-looking object.
Some of the high-voltage rectifiers did not have a cap on top of them until they got to extreme voltages. They may operate like at 5,000 volts or so, like, you know, 2AV2s. They didn't have a cap on top, but yet they were the focus rectifiers.
Okay, subject number four. If you go to subject number four, click on the link. It is going to open to you nuclear magnetic resonance systems, how a polarized helium-3 target. What I'm only interested with that is a certain pages, and that's a page 39, page 40, and page 41. Page 39 shows you a structure that is very much similar to a TK. In aquarium, he was using a horizontally and at 90 degrees, and so it would be horizontally and vertically placed coils. And I found that structure in here on page 39. Are you there?
I'm looking at page 39. It says coil orientation top view.
Oh, no, that's page 40, page 39.
Okay, page 39, blue background, right angle, red coils.
What is happening in here is you have an electron beam from the laser horizontally, that's a yellow line. And then you have a set of coils. They are at 90 degrees to each other. Now, it says in here, the drawing shows two sets of Helmut coils creating a DC holding field H. The RF coils are located above and below the target and generate RF field 2H1. The pickup coils are aligned along with the target chamber hidden here. Now, if you go to page 40, that's where the question arises. What it shows in here is they simply test that structure. So my question is, how the each of the fields of the coils interacts with the electron beam? And when you go to page next page, you have a chart that shows specification of what was the measurement. Now, it says that maximum frequency hertz was 10 kilohertz, okay, 100 kilohertz, beautiful. That's the range of the frequencies that I'm dealing with. Nominal inductance was 112 microhenries, and water cooling was not used at that time. Intercoil spacing, face-to-face 27 inches, 24 inches whatsoever. I'm trying to find out what is going on in here and to here.
Boy, that's a tough one without reading it.
Figure 2. The drawing shows the convention used for the holding field orientation. A zero orientation corresponds to the holding field pointing downstream. A 270 orientation corresponds to the field pointing at 90% from the beam line on the electro arm side. The target nuclear magnetic resonance polarization measurement can only be performed when the holding field is in the longitudinal parallel configuration pointing downstream, or in the longitudinal anti-parallel configuration pointing upstream. I remember John was having extended study on the nuclear magnetic resonance. I have spent also a large amount of time trying to understand that. I believe this is an addition to the overall understanding of nuclear magnetic resonance, John.
Wesley, that's one article I didn't look at, but yeah, it sounds like it's getting close to what we were dealing with nuclear magnetic resonant imaging. So it sounds right. The axis sounds right.
Yeah, figure number one on page 39 does say NMR setup, and it does show a little diagram up in the upper right-hand corner of a free helium atom. I guess free helium is lacking one of its neutrons, because ordinary helium has four. So I guess a free helium atom is something that can be oriented in an NMR machine. That's a bunch of guesses on my part.
John?
Yes, I find that unusual because they normally use hydrogen, which is seems to be a lot easier to work with and a lot easier to account for the events that happen because they're dealing with less elements.
So I think you're saying it's the hydrogen atoms in an NMR picture that are really being imaged. Is that true, John?
As far as doing the body work, yes. Body examining, as far as I know, it's all hydrogen imaging.
The reason I got into that is I'm trying to find to understand the influence of the electromagnetic field or magnetic part of the electromagnetic field on the electron beam and at a certain point. And also, I recall the material that we have discussed with the Army article when we were talking about destructive, active the nature of the nuclear magnetic resonance that was changing the structure of a metal, which was a carbon crystal at this time, just by giving two frequencies. As we know, nuclear magnetic resonance use a two different frequencies. I have a nuclear magnetic resonance device that is a heart of that experiment that I was related before. So, you know, I'm trying to find the major. What I'm trying to get is what is going on with all of this decay stuff. Trying to find any kind of relation. So, how the H field is I'm asking both of you, is interfering with.
I'll be back in a minute.
Adam.
KC2 WGV. There I have no idea. I haven't got a clue.
We have coils, just the coils in here. We have had if we have had a ferrite, we would have a line of 333 megahertz up to 335 megahertz. That's the only line. Manganium replacing zinc. And at 555 megahertz line, we were changing the structure. We were doing a transmutation of the material. And because we have an atom in here, we're just changing a position of an atom into a shear. It actually stands about the same. It simply stands about the fact of steady state of change and to exist. I'm sorry, one more thing. I was always trying to prove the point that nuclear magnetic resonance is not passive, it's active. That the body of the human being actively works in the process of the nuclear magnetic resonance, as there is an energy exchange of a deer, which I was told, no, it does not happen. Dick?
I have seen a PBS special where they did an NMR picture of a mummy. I'm pretty sure that was not a living item. So they made, now was that an NMR picture or was that a CAT scan? No, I'm pretty sure it was NMR. They've done NMR pictures of a mummy. I wonder if anyone else has seen that particular PBS special.
No, I did not. I would love to hear more about it.
Is that the one, Dick, where they put the cadaver in the NMR machine itself at a hospital?
I think so. This was a NOVA program investigating a mummy. I think it was that mummy that they found that at first they thought it was a living body, if you know what I mean. They thought it was a murder. And so they discovered how many thousand years old it was. It was a guy, I think alongside of one of the mountains in near Switzerland at a very high altitude. He had been frozen. He had been traveling from one place to another. They were analyzing the food that was in his stomach, the quivers that were in his thing, the weapons that he was carrying, the shoes that he was wearing. They were investigating all kinds of things, but they did put that non-living human being, who was thousands of years old, into something like an NMR machine. I wonder if you saw that one, John. Go ahead.
Oh, yes, Dick. In the Alps, they found him, and they calculated him at, I think, 5,000 years old. He died of an arrow wound in his back. I believe that's the one you're talking about. But he was frozen in that tundra, in that ice cave there, so the moisture was probably still in contact in his body.
A good point. So you're saying a completely dried out mummy, which doesn't have any moisture, would there still be anything to make an NMR picture of? You probably could do a CAT scan, but maybe you... We're not sure now you could do an NMR. Over to you, John.
Well, I'm pretty sure we couldn't do an NMR with the equipment that I know about, but there might be other forensic stuff they could do. Maybe look at different elements that are in there, but I have no idea. Interesting subject, though.
Hold on. There's another way of looking at this. If the MRI machine is really imaging hydrogen, there's a hell of a lot of dried substances that contain hydrogen. So I think you could still make an MRI image of a non-living object, even though you're imaging hydrogen. Over to you, John.
I believe you're right, Dick, but I think the resolution would suffer greatly.
Okay, so you're saying it's the waterborne hydrogen atoms, the hydrogen atoms that are in the water molecules that are in our organs, I think you're saying that's what's really giving you the contrast. Remove all the water, and I think you're saying there's a hell of a lot less to look at. I agree with that. But still, if the machine, is tuned correctly, I think you can still get a three-dimensional image. Could there be any kind of a dried substance inside of a mummy that contains absolutely no hydrogen, and therefore there's nothing to image? And if it images a hydrogen atom, is there a way of tuning the machine to image any other atom? Over to you, John.
I guess if we wanted to build a machine from ground up, yes, it just happened to be more convenient to go with hydrogen with the human. Now, when we're talking about a cadaver, I also saw that Egyptian mummy that was taken out of a cave and brought to a hospital, and a very famous male doctor, female doctor, they spent weeks unearthing this thing. They took it to a hospital. I don't think it was x-rays, but maybe CAT scans, because they could see the packets of organs that were placed in the body. So something was going on there, but I don't think that was resonant imaging.
I'm going to guess it was resonant imaging, John. And the reason I say that is I vaguely remember that that expert was looking at him very carefully, looking at the arthritis in his joints, looking at the decay in his teeth. They were getting all kinds of resolution. I don't think that CAT scan can do that. I don't think x-ray imaging has that degree of resolution, whereas MRI does. So I'm going to guess that that still was MRI imaging, possibly. Over to you, John.
Nick, that's a good question for my nuclear imager that does work for me. I'm going to ask him if that's possible to do. Probably is. I'm going to see what he has to say, and I'll check back with you on that.
At page 43, we have the SRS DS345 volt glitch string rotation. If you look at that, you see exactly where that NMR effect was reached. It says the first line is the offset value sent by the Macintosh to one of the function generators. DS345 is the function generator during the rotation. The output of the function generator on the second line with the glitch, and the input of the Wavetech function generator producing the TTL burst during the which the voltage is applied to the KEPCO power supply is kept constant. What I'm trying in here to understand is that if I know that the RF coils are located above the and below the target and generate the RF 2H1 field, where the Helmut coils create the DC holding field, the pickup coils are aligned along the target chamber. But the NMR could only be taken where the field pointing is at 90 degrees from the beam line, and the the target polarization measurement can only, or the target measurement polarization can only be performed when the holding field is in the longitudinal parallel configuration pointing downstream, or in the longitudinal anti-parallel configuration pointing upstream. So the schematic on page 40, that was the tilted one, was showing exactly the position. I'm trying to find the correlation between what we have when we look at the page with the pulses, and when we look at the drawing from page number 40 with tilted coils. Yeah, the correlation between pulses and drawing. The drawing, I see the 180 degrees laser beam longitudinal pumping. then I see the dotted line, which shows somehow a tilted at 19 degrees. I see the holding field, and it's then the vertical line says 270 degrees, and it's tilted I more than zero at the bottom of it. Maybe John would be able to have an idea.
No, Wes, I shut my computer down. I don't have that up anymore. So we only got 5 minutes to go.
Did you see page 46?
I'm going to get to that. Oh, measurement of the RF field. I did not. Page 46. RF mounting, the top car, the bottom coil, and the loop. This loop is pretty much similar to the experiment that I was talking about a few months ago. Principle of the measurement of H1 field using, for example, a wooden stick. The output of the loop is connected to your oscilloscope. The optimal position of the stick should give the maximum induced voltage when the loop is parallel to the RF coils. I know for sure that the aquarium TK had a set of coils that is very much similar to this one. You look also at the coil capacitor from Lithuania experiment. It's a similar structure as well. We have a loop, but the loop is the caduceus coil, and the ferrite is inside. Now, if you recall the Army experiment that I was talking about, that was permanently changing the nature of the ferrite, I see certain correlations between that. I had a pickup coil, and then I had a caduceus inside. So the caduceus inside would react as a loop. What I need is just to position the coil capacitor left and right to get to a certain point where the concentration of energy happens.
Gentlemen, I'm going to say 73s before we lose the repeater. You guys have a great weekend, what's left of it here. But don't work too hard. KC2WGB.
I'm going to be reading this a little bit further, but I'm going to have to leave you guys too. This was TechNet number 1381 of the series. More to follow. Bye-bye, you guys. One of these days, we're going to figure this all out. What is Mother Nature trying to tell us? Back to you, Wes. KQRIW.
I would like to thank you, Dick, again for your dedication and for your time spent with us and your education that you give us, especially to me, for all of this period of time that I'm in with TechNet. Thank you very much. Have a good night, Dick. Have a good night, John.
Good night, John, Wes, and Glenn. And I may not be as smart as you think I am. Bye-bye, you all.
You must face, because you know you're not that smart. Okay? We'll be good.
Thank you very much again.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active. Set tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Thank you. The time is 2:03 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system.
Try to experience what it's like to work off the repeaters. And tell you what, having a load of fun. And like I said, something you get in the car and it breaks up the time. You got so always have someone to talk to, so it's a nice thing. Back to you.
K1UFM return. Yeah, I have also have a 10-meter rig in the car, and a lot of times when the sun comes up, I'll start working the stations in Europe where the sun's been up for a while already. And on the way home at night, I'll usually work out into the west coast of Alaska. I've heard a couple of Japanese stations with only 25 watts haven't been able to work them. So yeah, it adds a bit of fun to the commute. I was first licensed back in 1962, and there have been periods where I've been active, inactive. I was inactive for a while, and finding some hams I work with coaxed me back onto the air. I'm glad I did. It makes the commute a lot more fun. Over.
Yeah, roger that. It's definitely, I'm enjoying it. I am definitely enjoying it. I have this little Yaesu 857, and I'm really loving it. It covers all the bands. I just have to kind of permanently set it up. Right now, I have a temporary thing going on in the mobile, but once I get set up, I'll be good to go. I definitely want to get on an HF band. I mean, 10 meters is probably the easier way to go, I would think. And but I really haven't had much luck on 10 meters, you know, even when I'm back home and I set it up in the house. Most of my HF I do on 20 and 40. I've been very successful on that. But definitely going to get into that 10-meter stuff. KD2BDC, over to you.
KB2VDC, K1UFM, returning. Yeah, as long as the sun is up, 10 meters is usually active. There's a repeater up in the Catskill of New York at 29620 FM. When the band is open, stations from Europe, West Africa check in like they're local. So it's kind of fun. 29620, remember that frequency. KQ2H, King Queen 2 Henry. I also operated from home, 15, 20, and 10. You need like a modified CB antenna or something for 10 meters of vertical, and then you get out pretty easily. I got a Linko DX70 at home, and in the car here I got a Radio Shack, old Radio Shack HX10. I know the 857 rig you're talking about is a nice radio. I've been thinking about maybe a little further down the road getting that for myself, then put the Linko DX70 in the car. So back to you, John, K1UFM Mobile.
K1UFM Mobile, KD2BDC. Yeah, Ted, it's definitely enjoying the rig here. It's a great little rig. It covers everything, and that's what I said. That's what's nice about it. But, yeah, I mean, right now I have... When I bring it portable, I kind of set up a dipole, and I like the dipole thing. I'm actually talking to you right now on a homemade dipole that I got. I made it as two Radio Shack replacement antennas, the telescopic antennas, so I could adjust the SWR easily. I tacked it to a piece of wood, threw coax on it, and I have it. It's mounted horizontally right now, sticking out of a fishing rod holder in the back of my pickup truck. Believe it or not, I mean, it was that simple. But when I go on HF, I do the same thing. I just throw up the dipoles. And I've been very successful on 20 and 40 meters. 20 meters obviously is easier because it's a smaller antenna. But, I mean, I spoke about a week ago on a piece of copper wire to someone in the Netherlands. So, I mean, that's the thrill for me. It's that. But I do have a 20-meter hamstick that I bought, and I tried it out on my truck once. And it seems to work pretty good. I made a few contacts on it. You know, the problem is it's such a big antenna, but, you know, I don't just drive around with that. That's real big. But otherwise, yeah, having a lot of fun with it. But I'm gonna write that down, 620, 29.620. And I did not realize that there was a repeater on that. And, you know, like I said, I'm new to all this, so I'm not sure how this all works. But any information that you could give me would definitely help. So this is KD2BDT. Back over to you, Ted.
KD2VDT, K1UFM Mobile, returning. Yeah, fine, finding the dipole. It's a good way to start off. Yeah, in this area on 2 meters, there's this Limewark repeater on now, which is probably the most active. There's a repeater up in Norwalk, Connecticut, GNARC, Greater Norwalk Amateur Radio Club. I think it's 146, 680 receive and 780 transmit. It's a megahertz offset for some reason. That's the most active one in the Fairfield area. You can reach it from Long Island easily. I can reach this repeater from where I live in Connecticut pretty easily. And those are probably the most active 2-meter repeaters. I don't know about 440 or 6. I'm sure there's something there. I was inactive for about 5 years and got back on about 2 months ago, so I'm just kind of getting back into the hobby myself. It's an interesting group of people. Over to you.
Well, like I said, so far everyone that I've had the pleasure of speaking to have all been a great bunch of people. Most of that's been on HF. And it's just been this past week that I started messing around with the 2 meter stuff. But the few people I have spoken to, once again, all great people, you know, and that's what's nice about it. It's a nice hobby, and everyone seems to be real, real nice. And that's, for me, one of the other things that makes it very enjoyable. So, and once again, you know, you're in the car, it's just something to do. You have the news on or the radio, whatever it is, and you get a little bored, you throw it on, and you have someone to talk to. It's a nice thing. Back to you.
Okay, when UFM return. Yeah, it helps with the commute. For a while, I was doing books on tape and books on CDs, and this adds a little more fun. I always got the cell phone, but I was at a radio club meeting up in Connecticut, the Greater Norwalk Amateur Radio Club. Has a meeting every second Wednesday of the week in Darien, and one fellow, Bernard, had his smartphone with him, and he had the EchoLink app on it. So, but with the EchoLink app, he dialed into this repeater and was talking to guys without even a ham radio, just to his smartphone and the EchoLink. Over.
Yeah, that's pretty cool stuff. It's amazing nowadays what you can do. It really is. But you said that this repeater, you hit this repeater even from up in Norwalk, because is that what you said? Over to you. This is KD2BDT. Back to you.
I can be sitting in my driveway in Norwalk, and I'm on the low power 10 watt setting for this radio, and I can hit the repeater fine with my 5/8 wave vertical. And you can hit the Norwalk repeater from where you are. I have one of those Wolfang, Bofang, low fat 2 watt handheld radios. I can hit the Norwalk repeater from Melville with that. So it's Norwalk repeater's up on like a 200 foot tower, and it's got great coverage. Over.
Yeah, roger that. I wonder if I could. I don't know if I could make, maybe. I mean, you know, I live on the south shore of Long Island. I'm in Long Beach, so I don't know. I mean, Melville definitely is north shore-ish, so it's definitely a little closer to Connecticut. But, you know, it's interesting. I'm going to give it a try and see if I can hit it. Back to you.
Yeah, during the weekend, we were talking to a fellow who was out by Kennedy Airport on a handy talking. He was hitting the roll-off machine. So I think you should probably be able to do it. I think that rig of yours has something like 50 watts on 2 meters, right?
Yes, that's correct. It does have 50 watts on 2 meters. And I'm not far from Kennedy Airport. I mean, I can see Kennedy Airport from the house. I mean, not that I can see it. It's close, but I mean, it's not far. A few air miles away. But, yeah, it would be, it's interesting to find out. I got to give it a try. Back to you.
If you go on the web, there's a list of 2 meter repeater frequencies. Just search 2 meter repeaters, or you go to GNARC, Greater Norwalk Amateur Radio Club's website. They'll give you the frequencies and the offset. I know Limewark has some meetings. I'm not sure when they are. But Limewark has, I think, almost 500 members, so it's probably the biggest club around. Over.
Yeah, roger that. I looked into that website, and I am, you know, thinking about maybe joining a club. It's definitely something that I'm looking into in the near future, possibly joining something. You know, it's just good because you can find out information. You know, you meet a bunch of guys. But as far as the 2 meter stuff, like I said, it's only been about a week now. And I guess I found a repeater directory online and found this repeater. And this appears to have the most action going on from what I can take. But that's the only reason why I dialed into it. But it kind of took me... It's like a good day to get set up. I'm having trouble figuring out how to set the radio up to the correct frequency and the tone and all that stuff and the offset. But now that I got it set, you know, it's in the memory and I know how to set the other ones up. But I'm glad I figured it out, and I'm glad I found out about this 2 meter stuff. Because like I said, this is great. You know, it's someone to talk to. Back to you.
I'm going to pause, but I'm going to go through the tolls here, and I want the police to think I'm on a cell phone.
Roger, roger. This is KD2BDC Mobile.
Okay, K1UFM return. Yeah, Limewark had something, but I think it was 2 weekends ago. They have it a couple times a year called Ham Radio University, where they bring you up to speed on some of the new digital modes. You know, it's classes for beginners and stuff. But, you know, they also have a pretty good Ham Fest flea market. You know, flea market is where you pick up all those coax connectors, cables, adapters, all that stuff here. You don't have and you need. That's a lot of fun. You make contacts for flea markets and whatnot. Back to you.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good stuff.
going to the flea market and getting all that stuff. It's hard to find that stuff around here. I mean, you can't just walk into a radio shack and find 50 old coax if you're looking at 12-inch panel play around. You know, you got to order it online, or you got to really try to search and find someone who sells. No one sells 50 old coax.